Hi, I'm Layla Hawkins, the web editor at Hospice UK. I am joined today by Rachel Clark, specialty doctor and author of a new book called Breathtaking, about working on the front line during the COVID crisis. Rachel, thank you so much for joining us today. I think it's pretty much exactly a year since we last spoke, and that was about your previous book, Dear Life. So with this book, you're sharing your experiences during the first wave of the pandemic. So I guess my first question would be, why did you decide to write this book?
Well, I think the main reason was because, like everybody in the UK, the first wave of COVID for me was just completely and absolutely overwhelming. I had experienced nothing like it before. And as a palliative care doctor, it was really momentous to move from a typical palliative care environment in the hospice where I work, where everything is about the human being in front of us. It's about making care personal and intimate and as kind and really obviously caring as possible. All of that changing and moving into a really frenetic and sometimes chaotic hospital environment where everybody was behind masks, we were all in PPE, and we were caring for patients who were dying as rapidly as anything we've ever known. It was an unprecedented situation, and I found I had to write about it really as a kind of therapy, not as a book, but I used to suffer from terrible insomnia in the first wave, and I used to just write in the middle of the night, and it was my way of expressing it. And then gradually in the end, that turned into what became the book. And I think I wanted people to know what it was really like. The doors of our hospitals were by and large closed then, and they still are now in the second wave. And I thought it was really important to try and show people what was happening, because although everything was so momentous and difficult with PPE and with visitors by and large not being allowed, some things were the same. We were still, as NHS staff, doctors and nurses, doing everything in our power to make sure really vulnerable patients at the end of life was still cared for, still loved despite everything. And I wanted to show that.
Towards the beginning of the book, you talk about leaving your husband and children at home every day, going to work, and the obviously health risks that the virus poses to them. What was going through your mind when you were on your way to the hospital each day?
Well, it was daunting back then. If you remember, we had no treatments, no vaccines. It was a completely new virus. We didn't know if our PPE was going to protect us. We didn't know if we were going to bring back coronavirus into our houses and infect the people we loved most of all. And all of that was really daunting. But I think I am just like everyone I know in the NHS and in my hospice, when I say that we didn't care. We wanted to be helping patients in need. And it was clear that the need was overwhelming, like nothing else in our lifetimes. And all of us, it was just simple. We wanted to be where the need was greatest. And that didn't make us heroic or brave or anything at all. We were frightened. I was frightened, but we wanted to do it. We wanted to do our bit. And I think what I used to see every day at work was fundamentally ordinary people, because the NHS is not populated by angels or heroes. We're just ordinary, frail human beings like everyone else, but doing extraordinary things because we needed to. And at the end of the day, I don't know what life is for if it isn't to try and help each other out when the need is there. And that's what I just saw every day in the hospice and in the hospital.
And you also talk about when you're wearing PPE and the discomfort of it and not being able to read people's expressions, of course. And you use the phrase feeling dehumanized, which I found interesting. Is this a feeling that has become common amongst NHS staff throughout this pandemic?
Yes, I think it is. And I think it has resulted in staff having to almost put on psychological as well as physical PPE at the start of each shift because you know that you're going into a working environment which is so far removed from what healthcare should be because of the barriers of PPE. There is always a mask between you and your patients, a layer of plastic covering your body, one or two pairs of gloves, a visor, and that isn't how any of us want it to be. We want to be up close and personal with our patients. And one of the greatest cruelties, I think, of COVID is that it doesn't allow that proximity. It forces these barriers between us, actually, when we've never needed each other more and we've never longed for closeness more. There's this concept in neuroscience of skin hunger, the idea that we are hardwired to touch, to need touch from each other. And if we don't have that, we hunger for it. And I think that's what we feel all the time. And it haunts you being dehumanized in that way because it goes against the grain of everything you learn at medical school, at nursing school, in your job. And you just long to be able to do it differently. And I know that, just as an example, one of the carers that I work with in the hospice, an amazing woman called Tracy, who has been there nearly, I think, 16 years, she said that she felt as though it was two different impulses at once battling away in her, the impulse to move forwards and care and physically care for patients that she's so used to versus the impulse to retreat and step back. Because if you are intimate in that way, then you run the risk of being infected. And it's very, very hard for staff feeling conflicted in that way.
The book's also dedicated to the NHS staff and care workers who sadly have lost their lives. And at the time of writing, the figure was 600. Now, I think it's closer to 900. At the time of writing, did you think that a year later we would still be in the grip of this virus?
No, I still sometimes wake up in the midst of this second wave, which is harder and deeper and more deadly even than the first wave. And I cannot believe we're here. We all knew there was a risk of COVID resurging in the winter because it's a respiratory virus, and that's what respiratory bugs tend to do. They run rampant in winter conditions. But I don't think anyone imagined we would be back among the death tolls of 1,000, 1,500, even 1,800 people on one day alone. I mean, that's so staggering. Excuse me, I can hardly believe it. And I think it's jaw-dropping. It's so painful to be here second time round. Everybody will make mistakes in a pandemic. When a pandemic unfolds and everything's new and bewildering and happening at pace, of course mistakes are going to be made, but and that's forgivable. But what isn't forgivable is not learning from those mistakes. And I think a great many of us just feel as though we should have locked down sooner. We could have reduced the deaths if we'd locked down sooner. And on today, the day that you and I are talking, we've just had the news that over 100,000 people in total have now died in Britain of COVID. And that just literally makes me want to cry. It's 100,000 bereaved families, 100,000 grieving families, and we shouldn't be here.
And yet, there has been a contingent of people who have been very strongly anti-lockdown, have been denying the seriousness of this pandemic as well, despite all the evidence that we have. Why do you think this has happened?
This is such a strange and distressing feature of the second half of 2020 and now in early 2021 as well. I think it's a very tiny minority of people, but very influential, very persuasive, and very aggressive sometimes. So myself and other frontline NHS staff, we actually are abused on social media by these individuals who will call us, I've been called Hitler or Satan or Harold Shipman for speaking out and saying COVID is real and deadly. And it's astonishing to us that people would try to deny the seriousness of COVID and literally say hospitals are empty when we are there 12 hours at a time and the conditions are, of course, desperately overwhelming. I imagine that there are many people who desperately hope that COVID is exaggerated because they are so unhappy with how the last year has been. They so desperately want it to end. They're worried about their kids. They want schools to be open. They've lost their job or they're in fear of losing their job. And they're desperately frightened about everything that's happening in society because nobody is unaffected by lockdown. And I think that's human and understandable. And we probably all share a little bit of that. But those people are very different to this really hardcore minority who seem to speak out on social media deliberately to try and misinform people and sow chaos and mistrust. And I cannot understand those people's motives because to my mind, it seems as though they're complicit potentially in causing more people to die and causing avoidable deaths by doing their utmost to spread distrust. And that's just completely wrong.
And as you just said, these are a minority, yet very influential people. What do you think of the way the media has portrayed this pandemic and what could have been done better in your view?
Well, I think there's been a tendency to focus on statistics. So we're often presented with very headline grabbing statistics. And sometimes they may be very bleak. They may be the 1,000 people who have died in the last 24 hours, for instance. But sometimes they might be big statistics about billions of items of PPE that have been distributed or the latest hundreds of thousands of people who've been vaccinated. And although I think statistics are obviously important, they're a form of data, it's easy to overlook the fact that fundamentally every single statistic is made up of real flesh and blood, loved human beings. Everybody who dies is somebody's mother, father, sister, brother. And actually, to appreciate the enormity of what we're living through, we need to try and hold in our heads the fact that these are human beings. They are loved human beings. They're so precious. They're so valuable. And I think in a way that was one of my driving motives behind wanting to write the book. I wanted to help people feel this, even though it's hard and we want to flinch away from it. This is not about numbers. This is about human beings. And I think I wish the media had focused more on the human beings that this is fundamentally all about as well.
And now thinking specifically about end-of-life care and palliative care, what has the impact of this pandemic been on hospices and on people needing palliative care?
Well, in some senses, it's been very, very difficult. So you'll know that in the first wave of COVID, especially the NHS was so overwhelmed that a lot of non-COVID care had to stop. It had to be put on pause. There weren't enough of us to go round. And so there was no avoiding that. And that meant that, for example, in cancer services, there were long delays in diagnosis and treatment. And that has meant that now we're picking up many, many cases of people who have got really serious illness in the hospice where I work especially, and that is terrible. It's one of the terrible costs of the pandemic. But more positively, I think the very fact of trying to provide good, humane palliative care despite all of the barriers of PPE and restrictions on visitors has taught us how very, very important that is. And I think it has renewed our determination to really ensure we do everything we can to be human at the bedside. And also it's forced us all as a population, as a country, to confront our mortality. We haven't been able to get away from the fact of our mortality. And I think that that might help in the really important area of advanced care planning. In other words, all of us as individuals having a think about how we might like our care to be at the end of life. Would we want to be in intensive care? Would we want to stay at home with our families? Have we talked to each other about that? Maybe we should have a chat about it so that we don't end up in a situation where one of our family is rushed into hospital and they're asked the question, what would mum have wanted? And no one knows the answer.
Going back to the book, you describe in the hospice having to ask patients who are very near the end of life what they want to do should they get coronavirus, how they would like to be treated. What were those conversations like?
Yes, this was one of my hardest days at work, I think, of my whole life, because we, at that time, and this was back in March last year, the hospice was filled with very, very sick inpatients on our little inpatient unit, and we needed to find out what their wishes were. So if they became infected, would they want to stay with us, or would they want to go to hospital and have treatment for COVID? And it's really hard to ask that question of somebody who is already very, very sick indeed. It's forcing them to consider something that they might not wish to. But if we didn't ask that question, then we wouldn't be putting the patient at the centre of the decision making. And that is so important. We can't make assumptions on our patient's behalf. What I actually found in those conversations was something astonishingly moving and just something I'll never forget. And that is, many of the patients, when I ask them that question, their first response is to say, it doesn't matter where I am. This is what I'd like. I'd like to stay in the hospice. But much more important than that is making sure I don't infect anyone else. So if the right thing for everyone else here is for me to go to the hospital, then send me to the hospital. I want to make sure I don't infect anyone else. And I just found that absolutely heartbreaking and extraordinary for patients who were so unwell to be that selfless and generous and think only of other patients, not of themselves, just said something really profound about human nature. And I felt as though I was seeing something really true and fundamental about human beings, about how strong and kind fundamentally people are. And I found it deeply moving.
This is obviously a very anxious time in terms of people who may need to seek care, who may be displaying symptoms. What would you say to them to reassure them at the moment?
Well, I think the most important thing to know is, although you may feel frightened about what lies behind the closed hospital doors, what you will find is what is always there in the NHS, and it hasn't changed one jot, and that is nurses, doctors, porters, carers, everyone else in the big wide team, they're doing their utmost for you, caring for you and trying to make sure that you're not frightened and you're not alone. We might be wearing masks and we might be covered in stupid plastic gowns, but that doesn't change who we are. And we know how important it is to help people with these frightening times. And all of us do everything we can to reassure people. And just to give you an example, in Oxford, in the John Radcliffe Hospital, where I sometimes work in our intensive care unit, where sadly, as you know, many people are dying from COVID. The team there had this absolutely unshakable principle that no matter how busy they were, how overwhelming things were with COVID, they would never, ever let anybody die alone. They would always make sure that if someone was felt to be dying, they would have a nurse or a doctor or a carer, somebody sitting with them, talking to them, holding their hand, because that is who we are in the NHS, and that is what we do for everybody. So although it may be daunting coming into hospital just now, you will get the same NHS people who are caring in the same way.
And what are your hopes now that there is a vaccine?
I am so astonished and thrilled, and I think literally ecstatic, that we now have got not one but two highly safe and highly effective vaccines against COVID licensed in this country. It just gives me cause for real hope and optimism. I think a very important caveat to that is when people are vaccinated, and that's happening wonderfully to hundreds of thousands of people a day now in the UK, it's really important not to assume that you are immediately protected, and crucially, that you will no longer infect anyone else with COVID. So it's still possible to be vaccinated, but infectious and infecting other people. So when you get your vaccines, just remember that for at least the first few weeks, you're still vulnerable, you haven't got protection. And also remember that you need to keep wearing a mask, washing your hands, socially distancing, doing all those things to protect the people around you. And so long as we keep on with those basic social distancing measures alongside the vaccination program, I feel so optimistic. I feel as though maybe summer 2021, we might have something of our old lives back.
Let's be hopeful. Well, your book Breathtaking is full of powerful stories. It's a gripping read, and it's out now, is that correct?
It is, that's right.
Wonderful. Well, it's a wonderful read. Thank you very much for your time again, Rachel. Always a pleasure to speak to you.
My pleasure. Thanks very much.